Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back. Today, we're going to be talking about exit plans for immigrant investors and what actually works. Before we get too far into it, I would like to introduce you to your host, Mona Shaw. Mona, how are you doing today?
Hi, everybody. I'm very well, Mark. Thank you very much. Yeah, this is one of those topics that everybody wants to know about.
Yeah, it's a huge question.
It is. But I think what the most important thing is to start off with, Mark, is to explain, because a lot of people don't understand this, that EB-5 is a very unique program. There's no other program like this anywhere where you can get residency, which will lead to citizenship on an investment, but the investment is at risk. And it's the at-risk element which does unnerve a few people.
Right. In fact, we've mentioned it on earlier episodes where we talked about offering documents and common red flags, or the EB-5 denial episode where we mentioned that the money actually has to be at risk. So people can't pull it out too early, nor can they. It is an investment, and they can't make an investment into something and look at some type of non-monetized return, such as real estate space and what's being built. So talking about exit plans for the immigrant investors, I think it's a great topic and one I'm looking forward to exploring with you. But I realize you've got Omar with us as well, right?
Hi, Mark. Good to be with you again. Yeah, this is a very important topic, probably one of the most important topics for investors to be aware of, because at the end of the day, they're looking for two things, their green card and their money back. And this episode focuses on the second part of that.
Yeah, we've done a lot of episodes on the green card.
Right. And it's good to have Omar here when we talk about getting money back, because he always stops us and says, look, you can't say that, or either you can't say it in the legal document, or don't say that. That's not true. So it's so glad to have Omar, the SEC guy here, to make sure that, we don't say anything that's not true.
Yeah, Mark, the most important thing is to understand is that there are many EB-5 projects out there looking for EB-5 investors. And again, this is to you developers who are listening as well as investors. What everyone tries to do is to present an EB-5 project where the risk is there, but it's not a risky quote-unquote project. And that's a huge challenge, and one where people have tried to deal with in many different ways, including things like promises. That's the real challenge. And there are many different ways that people have tried to deal with this.
Right. On an earlier episode, I think we even used the terminology to say that there's a wide range of risk there. There could be a very bad investment, or one that is not as bad, or maybe it's not as bad isn't the way to say it. But you're right. There are certain elements of risk, but understanding that there's various degrees of risk in the project, as well as what may work for the investor. I think this is a really good topic to get into. Your money has to be at risk, but does it mean risky? So hopefully we can explore that in this episode. So let me go ahead and ask the question directly to Omar. Omar, why can't we give a guarantee to the investors?
Well, the first part is there are no guarantees in life, so giving a guarantee might be a misrepresentation, but if you're speaking of something like a third-party guarantee or something of that sort, that is very likely to violate the at-risk requirement. If USCIS sees that, they're going to say this wasn't a real investment, it wasn't at risk, and therefore your 526 or 829 is going to be denied. And some people say, well, why wouldn't you just not include them in documents for USCIS? But then I'm looking at securities laws violation, because the investor needs to be aware of all the risk. And in the PPM, if there's a guarantee on the side that's not being disclosed, it needs to be in the PPM that this guarantee is likely to result in your 526 or 829 denial. And then boom, it's right there in the documents that there's a guarantee, and that's going to lead to a denial. So there's really no way to give a guarantee without violating either the at-risk requirement or securities laws or both.
Yeah, Mark, I should explain the reason behind the at-risk, because when this program was first established back in 92, the idea was that if you had an investor who would only invest in a project where there was a guarantee, they would never become quote-unquote entrepreneurs, because an entrepreneur is an investor who will take a risk and put it into a project where may not where there isn't a guarantee, and thereby by spreading sort of the investors and spreading the type of investments, you can have a wider range and you can really produce a better result.
Right. So if there's a guarantee, that means there's money just sitting somewhere not being used.
Right.
And that money could have been used to develop a project without EB-5. So if there's no risk, then there's really no job creation, which is the whole point of the EB-5 program.
It also sounds like there's almost a bit of a catch-22 to say if there was an investment, but it's not risky because we're going to put this guarantee in there, but we're not going to, you know, disclose the guarantee. Well, like you said, you have to disclose a guarantee, but then having that guarantee puts you at an immigration risk. So it's, and like I said, one of those catch-22s is, you know, there's going to be a risk, and the way the program is written, the risk should be in the investment. Obviously, not set up a risk for your immigration status or your immigration petition. You know, it's got to be in the investment. So I'm glad that's the focus for today's discussion is, you know, what is at risk, as well as, you know, how can investors get their money back and what are exit plans that actually work?
Right. And there's always going to be an at-risk element, but the way to minimize the risk is A, investing in a good project or business, which may be difficult for investors to evaluate themselves. But B, what is the capital stack and where does the investment lie in the capital stack? What the investors really want to see is a lot of equity coming in before them, and the equity absorbs risk. So the more equity in the project, the less likely it is that the money project will lose enough money so that you actually start sustaining losses as an EB-5 investor. And also, equity in the project demonstrates the confidence of the developer. They're putting their own money or some entity that they have a relationship with in the project, and that can help be a signal that they are confident that the project will be successful.
Yeah, that's especially important if you have something like an under 50% EB-5 component. If you have a project which is 80% plus of EB-5 money, I would think that was a risky project even before I saw the facts, just because the developers don't have any skin in the game.
Right. And then also when you get 80%, that means there's not a senior lender. And the senior lender, they usually come have higher priority in the capital stack than the investors, but at least having a senior lender eating up a big part of the capital stack shows that a reputable bank that's familiar with these types of projects has done due diligence, and they have some confidence in the project being viable.
Right. We discussed that a little bit on an earlier episode with banking and EB-5 and how a good bank lending that name, or at least working with a good bank, can lend credibility to the project. But I heard something about having too high of an EB-5 equity ratio and how that could be risky. So let me ask this question. You know, what's a good ratio of EB-5 money to have in a project?
It does depend on the project, Mark, but if we were going to talk about, I'll let Omar answer the real estate portion, but if we were going to talk about a non-real estate project, like the trucking industry or a manufacturing industry, where it's much more harder to actually see where the proportions are, I think for a project like that, you would look and see how much reputation and how much the developers have actually put into the project and try and assess it that way. But I think for a real estate project, there's a whole different kind of sort of set of rules.
Right.
So generally, real estate would be lower because people understand that a little bit more and it makes up the bigger portion of the EB-5 projects?
No, not necessarily. Well, yes, that too. But the other thing is for real estate projects, you're talking about a project which hasn't even begun, or it might have just begun. If we're talking about a manufacturing project or a non-real estate project, the likelihood is that it's a project which has actually got its wheels in motion, and therefore you are able to assess more accurately, maybe through some kind of revenue assessment. With a real estate project, as I say, it's usually just a concept.
Right.
Okay.
Right. In real estate projects, I would say what we typically see from conservative regional centers is wanting the EB-5 to be around 20% and see equity of around 30%. And then the senior loan being around 50%. That 30% cushion from the equity shows that developers have a lot of skin in the game. that they're confident the project's going to move forward, and then it's also just a nice cushion generally. And then the 50% from the senior lender shows that a serious bank who has all these regulatory requirements from the Federal Reserve and those type of entities have done their due diligence on the project, and they're comfortable lending a significant chunk to this project.
Yeah, a lot of people like real estate projects, Mark, because banks have been involved and banks have done their own due diligence. But at the same time, what I often caution some of the real estate projects we see, there is just too much bank debt. The EB-5 portion might be low, but then there are two or three other loans, major loans, and they all have precedence over the EB-5 debt. So you have to take that with a sort of grain of salt. Yes.
Well, yeah, you have to have the banks coming in to demonstrate confidence, and you also have to have the equity, which takes a lower preference in the EB-5. And then being in the sweet spot is where the EB-5 investors want to be.
Right. So really, the way forward for an investor, there's no hard and fast rule. Every project is different. And to move forward, they really need to understand certain exit plans. And I would say, Mark, that many of our investors who come, they're not business people. They're not people who necessarily understand how business works, how even banks work. And, they look and they often get swayed just by glamorous pictures.
Right.
And the way I try to often lecture or try and educate is looking at more of the basic stuff. When we look at exit plans, the first thing I say is that really, does it make sense?
Right. Well, I do want to get into exit plans,
yes,
but based off what you said, the marketing brochures can look slick and very appealing. And Omar mentioned the difference between equity and loan. So let's talk a little bit about the EB-5 investment in equity versus loan. And then perhaps that would be a good jumping off point. We can really dive into these exit plans. How do you get your money back? But first, before getting your money back, what's the type of business vehicle that it goes into? Equity versus loan.
Okay. Some cultures, interestingly, would not want a loan. They don't want to give loans and they don't want a loan back, their money back as a loan, but they want to invest in a project as equity. It's very interesting because the majority of time you feel that, oh, it's a loan and I want my money back. But as I say, there are some cultures, like, for example, some cultures like Iran, they don't want to have a loan. They'd rather have equity. But usually, 98% of the time, the project is designed around a loan. Either if it's a regional center, it's as a loan model, or if it's pooled, direct pooled project, it's designed, even though that's an equity structure, it's designed to be given back as a loan.
Regional center projects are typically loans just because that's what they're most familiar with, and that's what fits into the capital stack between the equity and the senior debt. Like, true equity investments are usually more in entrepreneurial cases where there are smaller projects. Each individual EB-5 investment is making up a significant part of the business cost. And in that case, you might have true profit sharing by the immigrant investors. And in that case, it's important to be an actual equity investment. Regional centers are almost always loan. Occasionally, you'll see preferred equity structured with similar terms to a loan, but the underlying business deal is similar to that there have been a loan. For whatever reason, they feel like preferred equity would help fit in the capital stack better than a loan, but the terms are similar to what you've seen in a loan agreement.
And I would add also that, having spoken to many, many, many developers, developers don't want to give an equity share because they feel like they put the hard work into the project. It's their contacts, it's their hard work, it's their idea. You want to loan out of this, then that's fine, but you don't deserve an equity share. And usually because they are presuming that once all the money goes in, there is going to be a huge profit or even some profit. And there is that element of ownership. So they don't want to dilute that ownership factor because that's one of the big advantages that developers do look for when they do go into EB-5, that EB-5 is a non-dilutive loan.
Right. And let's back up here. They're looking for an investment to really get this project off the ground, get this project to happen.
Right.
The investors are looking for this investment as a vehicle for their immigration status. And I would think that both parties really want to get out of this, right? I mean, they're happy to go in, but they also don't want to be tied up into this thing in perpetuity. So I can see why, you know, having equity may be a little bit more challenging for some developers versus a loan, because the loan terms are pretty well laid out, where, you know, some equity stacks could be, you know, a little bit different to, I guess, push an equity investor out of that. I'm just guessing.
No, you're absolutely correct, Mark. And also don't forget that if you're an equity shareholder, you have an element of the liabilities as well. There are different responsibilities attached to you. If you're just making a loan and say the business does collapse, you may lose your $500,000, but nobody else would come after you for any other share. Whereas if you are putting, if you're one of maybe two investors going into a restaurant or some kind of a smaller business, smaller entity as enterprise, and the business goes down, you may be liable for other costs. So there is that huge risk too, which is, again, one of the reasons why, of course, loans are more attractive than equity projects.
So both parties really want this investment to end, both the project developer right. and the immigrant investor. In fact, I guess to be an investor, there has to be some expectation of return. So I imagine that, is it true that immigration services are going to look at how, if there is a mechanism in which to pay the investors back?
Yes. If there's not a chance of return, then USCIS, especially recently, has been saying then it's not a true investment. And that may be basis for denying the 526.
Okay.
So usually there'll be a small percentage that the investor will essentially get as a preferred return, whether it be through interest on a loan or through, you know, a preferred equity return. And usually they will, at the end of the day, when the, you know, the EFI process is winding down, if the business has been a success and there's lots of money to go around, the investors will be entitled to get their money back, their original capital contribution of $500,000, and then a small return on capital. And then anything else left over will go to the principals of the project.
And this is a good part to get into the meat of discussion. And that is, what are some of the preferred exit plans for immigrant investors? So what would you say is the number one exit vehicle that you see most EB-5 projects, the successful ones, using to pay their investors back?
There's no one rule, Mark. There's no one rule. The main exits are basically four things. They are cash exit, a refinance, mortgage. You can go into municipal bonds, and people have tried property ownership, and I'll explain about that, but that hasn't been successful. Or there's a combination of more than one, maybe cash and refinance or cash and mortgage together. And again, it really depends on the project. You may recall we had the episode with Bob Friedman when Bob was discussing the current situation of the condo market or the high-end condo market in somewhere like New York City right now. And New York City is supposed to be the capital of real estate. Right now, at this point, we're talking early 2016, the condo market is moving very slow. And if your exit plan is just on sale and sale alone, then you have to just wait until the price is right before those condos get sold and everybody gets paid off.
Right. So you mentioned cash, refi, bonds, particularly municipal bonds, as well as the sell of the project. And as you pointed out, that project developer, you know, really went into details about sales, or at least selling the project, and how it can really be dependent on the market and sometimes be delayed because a strong project that has a healthy financial backbone, they're not going to sell or even, you know, liquidate right away. They're going to wait a couple of years. So you're saying that in conjunction with a planned sell exit strategy, there could be other exit strategies alongside of selling the project?
There have been attempts. There's been several attempts. There's been a project, there was more than one actually, projects whereby there was a promise of owning part of the property. And that had been denied because that was considered a guarantee. The case which was actually denied went to the AAO, and it was a case whereby the project was the refurbishment or redoing of a big Marriott hotel, not Marriott, sorry, it was a Ramada Inn hotel in Florida. And the issue there was that even if the project didn't succeed and it failed, then the investors would have this a particular room allotted to them. And the project was that the room would be all done up and refurbished, etc. And even if the project failed, they would still have this room, even though it wasn't refurbished. So because there was a guarantee of something, USCIS denied it, and then the AAO subsequently also denied it. So investment guaranteed by property ownership doesn't work because it doesn't fit in with the at-risk requirements.
Exactly. So with a sell exit strategy, there can't be that guarantee contingency of, hey, we'll give you the condo that doesn't sell, because then that's almost a guarantee. Do some of these other exit vehicles, such as it sounds like a refinance or a municipal bond, may be one that works out well in conjunction with this. Are there other exit strategies that work well with sales, or are they usually independent of each other?
Well, municipal bonds are a little different, and we do have a show coming up about bonds, because bonds are difficult to understand for a lot of people. They are kind of simple and they're difficult. People who deal with bonds think that they're the safest of risks, but people who don't really deal with bonds don't really understand the exit strategy, because you have to sell the bond after 5 years. And then there was this all a long time before USCIS even accepted that a bond wasn't at risk, that it came under the at-risk category, because there are two types of bonds. There's the municipal bonds, and then there's general obligation bonds. And I don't really want to go into all of that today. Safe to say that most of the time, bond projects tend to be related to something to do with the state or infrastructure or some big type of project. And they're not that common. There's only a handful of projects which use municipal bonds.
Yeah, it sounds like a good idea to defer that discussion later when we have the time to really dive into yeah. bonds. So let's talk about refinancing. What are the types of refinances that you see in order to pay back EB-5 investors?
Right. Usually the money from the EB-5 investors goes to the project through a loan, usually a loan that's junior to the loan that a bank will make. When it's time for the EB-5 investors to, you know, withdraw from their project after they've already gotten their permanent green cards and want to move on, what they try to do is refinance the loan that they made with another loan from a bank or some other investment entity. The important thing to be able to refinance a loan is for the project to be a success, to be generating cash flows that can sustain the loan, especially since it's no longer an EB-5 loan, it's coming from a third party, it's probably going to be at a higher rate than the EB-5 loan. So the important thing is that the project has been moving forward on time, has been generating operating income, and can now sustain a loan that will be at a higher rate than the EB-5 loan.
Right. And the important thing here, Mark, to see is, so if you look at the type of projects which are on the market right now, as Omar correctly says, you know, has it been up, moving on time? Now, if you have a large-scale project, have there been delays? If there have been significant delays in the putting up the building, then there are going to be delays in having it operational and stabilized. And if there are delays in getting it stabilized, there's going to be delays before it can get refinanced. It's not a question of whether or not the EB-5 investors will get their money back. They all probably will get their money back, but it may be delayed heavily. So instead of getting it back after 5 years, they probably would get their money back after 8 years or even longer. And we have seen a lot of that lately, because a lot of projects are maturing, and large-scale real estate projects were not really designed to give you your money back after 5 years. My personal preference in real estate has always been mid-sized, just because I have seen the issues relating to large-scale projects.
Yeah, that makes sense. I would think you could move a smaller or mid-sized project easier than looking for, you know, the perfect buyer for a large project.
Right. And then the other issue is with refinance, if you're talking about a hotel, for a hotel to be refinanced, there are so many components that a bank looks at. And most of the time, and this again was mentioned by when we had that episode with Bob Zlosky from Signature Bank, a hotel is often refinanced at only 30 to 35% of its value. So if it's not correctly valued from the outset, or if the market has dropped for any reason, then there's going to be less money coming back in on the refinancing side. And if there's a lot of debt, then the EB-5 investors who will be pushed right at the bottom of the stack, and they're less likely to get all of their money back. So, you know, this is another reason to look very carefully, not only at whether it's a hotel, but where is the project located? And is it a flag? And who are the developers behind it? And how many have they done? And what kind of equity and capital stack is there?
Okay, well, let's talk about that fourth strategy that you mentioned, and that's cash. You know, how do you pay an investor back with cash? What are the typical projects that use cash to pay back investors?
Well, this is my favorite type of exit plan, Mark, because I feel like cash, there is more control, but not every project deals with cash, and certainly not real estate projects. If you may recall, when we had that episode with Bob, and he was Bob Friedman, and he was talking about
last episode, I certainly
do. And he was talking about the theme park and the roller coaster. And what he stated was that there was going to be a lot of cash coming in on a project like that. Mm-hmm. And he would be able to, even if there was not enough cash up front, the cash coming in would be as enough to satisfy a bank for him to be able to get a mortgage to pay back the EB5 investors. That's one way of looking at cash when you're looking at cash coming in on a large project. On a smaller project, there is probably, if it has a good cash flow, there may be the likelihood that there is straightforward cash being able to be put aside to pay back the EP5 investor. The type of project which gives you cash, though, are very few, as I've stated. They usually are things like franchise restaurants, again, something like this theme park. Of course, anything transport-related, they're usually cash cows. Omar, can you think of any other cash project?
I would just say franchisees, things that are operating day-to-day.
Right.
That don't have, with real estate, you have a huge investment that's supposed to pay out over many, many years. And then you also have the real estate itself. You know, property maintains value usually for long periods of time. But a cash business is something that you're not expecting the long life cycle of the project.
Right. It's the difference between having a nice capital asset on the balance sheet that which you could leverage, or have a healthy P&L where you've got so much more profit than loss, and you can generate that cash. And I do like you really highlighting those two methods in which cash can be used to pay back the investors. Obviously, there's one that most people would think of, and that's, well, directly. You got the money, you just pay the investors. But you also mentioned that cash could be used for stability payments against a loan. So if there's a lot of EB5 investors with that cash, they could go ahead and get that loan to pay it with really good terms. As you mentioned, you know, cash can lead to flexibility. So you probably get a loan with even better terms, pay back your investors and make those payments with the cash, you know, with the anticipation that your project or what have you is going to continue to grow. So the excess cash generated would obviously go back to the existing equity people.
Yes, that's true, Mark. But you have to look. It's a project. It's a case by case basis. There is a project. It's a very nice project. It's a cute project. However, their payback. I'm really not at liberty to state the name of the project, but their payback, their exit plan is via the sale of beer, which they would produce themselves. For me, that would be a little risky because I understand how the beer market works and how competitive it is. And there would have to be an awful lot of sales generated in order for them to make the type of profit where they could pay back the investment. So I think, again, it really depends very much on the type of cash generated and where it's coming from. As well as, I think, as for cash projects, the investor really needs to understand, well, what are the other outgoings going to be paid? I mean, how much else is going to come in and, you know, take away from that money? Because when you're talking about a real estate project coming in and you have the refinance and you're paying off a mortgage and you're paying off a construction loan, you can see what the debt is. But in a cash project, there might be other debts which aren't even shown, like day-to-day operational management and things like that.
Right, exactly. So with these four methods in mind, cash, the one we just talked about, but as you mentioned, doesn't happen very frequently. And some projects that try to use it really don't have a good understanding of what their future profit and loss statement may be. But there's also sales and bonds and refinance. Does it make sense to not issue guarantees, but to mix a couple of these potential payback strategies in the private placement memorandum? Or do you not see that?
Right. Well, for a real estate project, you always want to have the option of selling the project or refinancing. It's hard to predict exactly what's going to happen in 5 to 7 years. So normally you'll see refinance and sell, mentioned as potential.
And that's something that an investor should look for, right? Two strategies right there, either sale or refinance.
Right. And I think also an investor needs to look at the overall viability of the project and what the history really shows. And then I always say to the investor to see whether or not, is it a recession-proof type of project? If tomorrow there was another recession, would that affect the payback on this project? Because what is happening now, Mark, we have some amazing projects coming into the market. The situation with EB5 has changed a lot compared to what it was 8 or 9 years ago, when there were very poor deals there on the market. And those poor deals were unlikely to either even attract refinance or even sales or anything. Some of the projects out there right now are excellent projects. And it's easier to see. There's more transparency. I think USCIS do demand more. I think the documents have been prepared in a better way. And I think it's easier to see whether or not you are likely to get your money back if there is a general viability for a project. Location is huge. Location of whether it's a restaurant or whether it's a hotel, wherever it is, has some bearing on the project, as well as the management.
Okay.
Well, Mark, I think we've touched the surface here. There's an awful lot to discuss when it comes to exit plans. There's a lot of details that people really, that listeners, developers, et cetera, really do need to understand. So the way to go forward, Mark, is there's no one hard, fast rule. You have to look at each individual project and you have to look at the exit plan, and it has to make sense. And I often say just look past any glamorous marketing materials and look at the essential elements of that project.
That's a good point. Look carefully at the exit plan and think to yourself, does it make sense? Well, let's do this, Mona and Omar. I realize that we have only 30 minutes to really dive into this topic of exit plans, but now let's open up to the listener. If they have questions on exit plans, let's invite them to come on to the show notes page, mshawlaw.com, where this show is also hosted, and type in a question in the comments section, and let's continue the discussion there, because I'm sure that there's probably more questions out there than what we've answered.
Absolutely, yes.
Mona, Omar, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Or call the office at 212-233-7473. Don't worry about trying to write all this down, as it's already embedded in your podcast player of choice. The contact information and other valuable resources can be found there. I hope you enjoyed this episode on EB5 exit plans that actually work. We've covered a lot of ground, and if you have any questions, please feel free to reach out to Mona Shaw & Associates. The next episode is our 10th episode, and we are going to be discussing a little bit about the EB5 program, but we're going to be focusing mainly on the United Kingdom's Investment Visa program and how it compares to the EB5 program. You're going to hear some plus and minuses on, well, both programs, both for the United Kingdom and the United States. Make sure you don't miss it by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB5 Investment Voice.